$30. Those ran out very quickly. Digital cameras and GPSs are also big. You know, this is an electronics store, and the people here seem to be rather excited about electronics.
NPR's Tamara Keith in Alexandria, Virginia. Now, the Black Friday rush for bargains at retail chains nationwide turned deadly at one Walmart today. Police in Long Island, New York say a 34-year-old Walmart employee was knocked down in a stampede shortly after the store opened early this morning. Authorities say shoppers physically broke down the doors. Police report the employee later died at a hospital. Wall Street is only open for half a day. Currently, the Dow is up 57 points at 87.84. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
WILL programs are made possible in part by the Jane Addams Bookshop on North Neal Street in downtown Champaign. Jane Addams Bookshop is a full-service antiquarian bookstore, buying and selling used and rare books, open 7 days a week.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
And welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Dale, Kyle Mabry is at the controls. Again, in this hour, we will reach into the Focus 580 archives for a previously broadcast show. This is a program that we first aired on August 26th of this year. So as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we will not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be looking back to what life was like in Cuba, particularly in Havana, in the 1950s. At that time, Havana was growing at a staggering pace. Very, very large amounts of money were going into this country. In fact, Cuba at this time ranked third among the nations of the world receiving American investments. And a lot of the money that was going into Cuba ended up in the pockets of some of the most notorious underworld figures of the day, who hoped to turn Cuba into a kind of a criminal state, one where they could operate free from government or law enforcement intrusion. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about this time in Cuba with T.J. English. He is the author of a newly published book. The title is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. It's published by William Morrow and has come out recently. T.J. English has done a lot of writing about organized crime in the United States. He's the author of Patty Whacked and the Westies. Those were both national bestsellers and were about Irish Americans being involved in organized crime. He's also author of the book Born to Kill, America's Most Notorious Vietnamese Gang and the Changing Face of Organized Crime. That book was nominated for an Edgar Award. He's also written for a number of other publications, Esquire, Playboy, The New York Magazine, among others. And he's also been a screenwriter. His credits include episodes of the TV crime dramas NYPD Blue and Homicide. And he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about the new book, Havana Nocturne. Mr. English, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
There are so many great stories here, not surprising that somebody would want to write a book about this point in time in Havana. Just tell us, just pick one story if you could, just to start us off, a story that would say something about what life was like in Havana if you were somebody who had money and you were looking for a good time.
Well, let's start with one of the more salacious anecdotes. Why don't we do that?
Good. Let's do that.
Among other things, Havana, Cuba, in this period of the 1950s, when it was controlled by the mob, run by the mob, it had become a kind of what some refer to as a kind of X-rated Disneyland. It was a little playground for tourists and mob associates. It all started with the casino gambling. There were a number of lavish casinos in Havana, and there were a number of lavish nightclubs like the Tropicana that had fabulous floor shows, and there was a hot music scene, Afro-Cuban jazz. The mambo was a popular dance during this era. There were a lot of things happening in Cuba, and tourism season after tourism season, people would flood down there. It also was a very popular junket for American politicians, senators, congressmen, businessmen would travel to Cuba, would travel to Havana for a three or four day weekend, and they would get comped down there by the casinos and the nightclubs, and they'd get treated like royalty. A young senator by the name of John F. Kennedy was down there in December of 1957. He was with a group of senators, including a friend of his, Senator George Smathers from the state of Florida. While in Havana, George Smathers introduced John Kennedy to some of the more notorious mob figures that were operating in Havana, most notably Meyer Lansky, who was kind of the leader of this whole operation, and a mafiosi by the name of Santo Traficante, who was from Tampa, Florida. Santo Traficante sensed that the young senator, Kennedy, had a yen for the ladies, and so he set up a tryst for Kennedy with three young Cuban prostitutes in a hotel room, the Hotel Comodoro, in a nice neighborhood in Havana. It was an afternoon tryst to take place there, and what Kennedy didn't know was that room had been outfitted with a two-way mirror, and Traficante and an associate of his watched that tryst take place, and they talked about it often afterwards. Traficante talked about it with his attorney and always kicked himself for not having filmed it or photographed it in some way, because it would have made terrific blackmail material for the mob.
For people like that, or other people who were going there to gamble or to have a good time, even people back in the United States who knew about Cuba, would there have been any doubt? Would everybody have known, maybe not to the last letter, but everybody would have known just how deeply organized crime was entrenched there in Havana?
I don't think they would have known how deeply it was, but they certainly knew that it was there. And in fact, that was part of the allure of Havana. Havana was considered a little notorious. They knew that there was it was known for having a sexual marketplace there, and it was known for having casinos and nightclubs that were owned and run by some of the more notorious mobsters, mob figures in the United States. In 1958, in January of 1958, when this was all really booming down there, the Steve Allen Show. Steve Allen Show was one of the more popular variety shows on television in the 50s. He was sort of the Jay Leno Tonight Show of its day. The Steve Allen Show did their show live from the Riviera Hotel Casino in Havana, one show. And the Riviera was owned, constructed by Lansky. Steve Allen's opening line of that show, I watched the show at a broadcasting museum here in New York City. The opening line of that show was, "Welcome to Havana, Cuba, the home of the pineapple and Meyer Lansky." That was his opening line of the show. So they knew. Everyone knew. It was part of the naughtiness of Cuba, the nefariousness of Havana that drew the tourists down there.
Well, and I'm sure clearly that for some people, particularly people in show business or other people who were just going, as I say, going there for a good time, that little brush with the mob, that little brush with the dark side probably made it made it that much better for them.
Yes, it made it that much more attractive. I mean, that was part of it. You know, that the line we use now about Las Vegas, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, that really was originated in Havana because, you know, you were going to another country. You really were leaving the kind of media bubble of the United States. And you could go down there and you could rub shoulders with known mob figures. And also a lot of celebrities were down there during this era of the 50s. That was part of the draw. Also, all the major movie stars and entertainers of the day passed through Havana during these years. So anyone who was there, if you ever meet anyone who was there in the 50s and you ask them about it, you'll see their eyes light up, and they will have stories to tell you, or they will have stories that they can't tell you about the time that they spent in Havana.
Yeah. One of the things just right up front in the book, you talk about during this period of time, say right after the war and through the late 50s, just how much money, and it was a staggering amount of money, and at the rate of increase also was staggering, just how much money that there was going into Cuba at that time.
Yeah, there really was a staggering amount of money there. I mean, the mob set their sights on it way as far back as the 1920s and always had this dream of having a base of operations in Cuba. But it really wasn't until the post-war years, post-World War II years of the late 1940s, that they were able to put all the pieces together and make it happen. And part of that was, it was a combination of mob investments, you know, the mobsters themselves investing money into the casinos and the nightclubs. But it also was American corporate investment that was taking place in Cuba. A lot of natural resources in Cuba were owned by major American corporations, sugar, of course, being the number one product in Cuba. Also, public utilities like telephone lines were owned by American corporations. You know, this is part of the resentment that would eventually lead to the revolution. But this sort of investment on the part of the United States made it appear to some as if American corporations and the mob and corrupt politicians in Cuba were kind of all in it together.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, T.J. English. His new book is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution, published by William Morrow. He's written a number of books. He's written quite a lot about organized crime in the United States. This book certainly, as we have discussed, is about that, about how American figures involved in organized crime were very much involved in Cuba at that particular time, the time we're talking about, so sort of the 1950s. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You explain in the book that, and as you were just mentioning, that, say, going back to the time of Prohibition, organized crime was involved in Cuba to the extent that it was a transshipment point for liquor,
right,
that they were bringing into the United States. So that in a sense, they had kind of a hold there. And that,
yes,
then it was, though, the particular dream, particularly of Meyer Lansky and I guess his associate, Lucky Luciano, that they could literally turn it into a kind of criminal state. And that,
yes,
it took some time for that to be worked out, some 30 years, I suppose, really. Partly, I suppose, that also had to do with their cultivation of the Cuban government and building connections, particularly connections between them and Batista.
Yes, yes. The key relationship here was the relationship between Meyer Lansky and Fulgencio Batista. Fulgencio Batista was the dictator in Cuba in the decade before Fidel Castro took over. But he also had been a power in Cuba going all the way back to the early 1930s. Batista had rose to the head of the military in Cuba, and in Cuba the military really was the supreme power on the island. Presidents came and went, but the leader of the military stayed the same. So Batista was the strong man on the island, and Lansky was astute enough to sense that Batista would continue to be a major player in the life of the Cuban people. But by the years of World War II, Batista had gone into a kind of semi-retirement and was living in Daytona Beach, Florida. And that was when Lansky and some of the others went to him and said, look, it looks like after years of delay, after a long depression in the United States, after World War II, it looked like there was going to be another tourism boom in Havana, like there had been back in the 1920s, and the mobsters wanted to be in a position to capitalize on this, and so they knew that they needed Batista back in power. And so Batista returned to Cuba and was running for president in the early 1950s, 1952, and he wasn't doing so well in the polls, and so he got his military cohorts together and simply took over the government in a coup d'etat. He chased the existing president off the island. He called off the election. He suspended the constitution and took over the country. And this was, of course, an event that would change the course of Cuban history on a number of levels, one of them being that one of the first things Batista did as president in 52 was bring Meyer Lansky back to Cuba and called him his director of gambling reform, which was an irony, to say the least. So all the pieces were finally in place for the mob to begin this full-scale exploitation of Havana that they had dreamed about for decades.
And what's interesting here, the sort of the irony, is that full-scale exploitation of the country and the connections between the mob and the government helped to foment revolution, because obviously the Cuban people, and most of them were not getting rich, they knew about the ties between organized crime and the government, and it added to that image that it was a corrupt government, and that only worked to the advantage of Fidel Castro and the people who were involved in trying to overthrow the government.
Yes, but this would all take years for it to reveal itself to the Cuban people, because initially a lot of these relationships weren't quite so obvious or well-known. It really wasn't until around, as the 50s wore on, this period from about 52 to 59, each tourist season was bigger and more prosperous than the one that came before, and it started to become apparent that there was incredible amounts of money being generated. The gambling network in Cuba was so elaborate, not only the large casinos, in every hotel you had a casino, a major casino. In a lot of the nightclubs, you had a casino. And then you had what they called the one-armed bandits. The slot machines were everywhere. Every corner bodega had slot machines in it. And the president's brother-in-law controlled the slot machine concession. All of that money went to the president's brother-in-law. And so and people knew of the notorious gangsters that were running the casinos. And there was a famous mob hit that took place in the United States in 1957, a notorious gangster by the name of Albert Anastasia, had let it be known that he wasn't very happy with the way the spoils were being divided amongst the various mob factions, and he started to kick up a lot of dust down there, and he visited Cuba and made his unhappiness known, and then came back to New York City and wound up being whacked while sitting in a barbershop in Midtown Manhattan in the middle of the morning. A famous mob hit, October of 57. It grew out of the Havana operation. So eventually people began to see that there were a lot of corrupt elements that were controlling the daily economic life of the city of Havana. And so that started to fuel the unrest that had existed in Cuba probably for many generations, stemming primarily from just the disparity of wealth in Cuba, the post-colonial structure in Cuba, where you had a military dictatorship that controlled everything, and major oligarchies and families and American corporations that controlled all the wealth on the island, and a large percentage of the population living in poverty. That was the real roots of the revolution. What the situation in Havana did was provided a kind of garish symbol of moral degradation and exploitation that was taking place, that became a powerful symbolic impetus to the revolution. It became a kind of focus of their energies. Kicking the mobsters out of Havana became a kind of symbolic way to judge how successful the revolution was going to be or had been.
Yeah, and that was something that it seemed that the mobsters didn't really quite understand.
No.
Because their thought was, well, revolution, you know, that's not going to be a problem. The casinos, we're all making so much money. Even if there is a revolution and they take over the government, they're not going to shut us down because we're making too much money for everybody. Well, when the revolution did come, one of the first things they did was shut the casinos down.
Yeah. Well, the mobsters completely underestimated what was happening with the revolution, and they weren't the only ones. The revolution seemed like quite a long shot, especially in these early years around 52, 53, 54. Castro brothers were thrown in prison for almost 2 years, and then when they were released by Batista in an amnesty, probably the biggest political mistake he made in his life, they went to Mexico City and met Che Guevara and started to formulate a plan to invade the island and foment revolution on the island. And they did that and landed on the island and were basically wiped out by the Cuban military, who knew they were coming And a handful of them escaped up into the hills, including the Castro brothers and Che Guevara. And so the revolution looked like quite a long shot at that point, around 54, 55. It was just a dozen or so guys up in the hills against this thriving machine in Havana with all the fabulous wealth that was being generated by the casinos and the nightlife. Now, I should mention also that the mob infiltration of Cuba went much deeper than the casinos and the nightclubs. That was the surface aspect of it, and that certainly did generate a lot of the fabulous wealth. But mobsters also owned banks in casinos, and they also had controlling interests of government financial lending institutions, so that a lot of the money that was being generated by the casinos and criminal rackets in Havana were being funneled back into financial lending institutions, so that virtually every bridge and tunnel and highway that was built in Cuba during this period was partly being financed by mob money. And that was kind of unprecedented in the history of American organized crime, that the mob could actually have that kind of control, where they were controlling the daily financial life and development of the country. It's pretty extraordinary.
Mm. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. You want to join the conversation? 333-9455. That's the Champaign Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign County where we are. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned the politicals going for junkets. If I remember correctly, at that time there were only casinos in Las Vegas and Atlantic City, right? So I'm wondering how much mob money blowback was affecting the political system. You know, the mob was always trying to launder their money into good, safe, legit investments, some of which probably were politically affected. And I'm just wondering how much of that, you know, how many tunnels in the U.S. were maybe affected not as blatantly as when you have a dictator like Batista, but
right.
But I'm wondering whether you found anything about that, or
yeah, that
I have a meta question too, which is hopefully I'll have a chance to.
Okay, well, let's take that one. That's an interesting question. Yes, you have to remember though, in this period of the 50s, although Vegas, you know, some of the Vegas casinos were being built in the late 1940s and in the 50s. Vegas, the booming Vegas Strip, Vegas as we know it today, really didn't get up and running until around the mid-60s. And in fact, could be argued that the fall of Havana, the closing down of the casinos in Havana, was the best thing that ever happened to Las Vegas, because they were something of competitors at that point. And Atlantic City really didn't develop until much later also. So Havana was the preeminent gambling scene for high rollers, you know, people who were on the gambling circuit. They'd go to Monte Carlo and a few other places around the world, and Havana was one of those places. Money was being generated, funneled back into mob operations in the United States, no question about it. Cash couriers were running money from the island of Cuba to the United States back and forth throughout this whole period of the 1950s. Lansky and Traficante on a weekly basis moved money off of the island into accounts of theirs in Florida, and also the accounts of theirs elsewhere around the Caribbean. Batista, who was the dictator, who was making huge amounts of money, he was getting a weekly payment under the table of $1.28 million in cash delivered to the presidential palace through a back door. This is in 1950s money, by the way, so you can multiply that many times over, probably somewhere around $10 million. A weekly skim percentage of the casino rackets of $10 million. So the amount of money that was being generated was really off the charts. Did that money wind up being invested in operations in the United States, mob operations? No doubt. It's impossible to calculate that, because there's no bookkeeping. There's no such thing as underworld bookkeeping. There's no records. But we do know that the mob used money in the United States for a lot of things, one of them being to influence politicians to juice the political system, particularly back in the era of the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. So there's no question that mob money was being used for nefarious mob money generated by what was happening in Cuba was being used to finance criminal activities in the United States,
including criminal political activities, I guess.
I'm inclined to say yes to that, although, you know, like as with so much of this history, it's just hard to document it, mm-hmm. you know, in a way that you could ever prove it in court.
Right.
But we do know it's been written about a lot of all the sort of mob factors that came into play that played some role in the election of John F. Kennedy in 1960. So the reason I mention that incident with Kennedy going there in 57 is because to me it's kind of an interesting anecdote when you stop to think that later in the 50s the mob helps John Kennedy get elected president through their relationship with John Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy.
I have an idea, which is that why do we have to believe a gangster when he says he didn't take photographs? Because I can imagine them easily giving him some souvenir photographs and some money and saying, you know, you're our guy.
Well, those photos would likely have surfaced somewhere. Someone would have seen them.
Yeah, possibly. The other question is, I'm sure since you've been on the book chat for a while, that you get the question about, you know, did the mob have anything to do with killing Kennedy? And I'm just wondering how often you get that, and how you answer it, really.
Yeah, I was sort of working towards that.
Right.
I think there's tons of evidence that suggests that the mob was involved in the Kennedy assassination. And this link to Havana is interesting because one of the key players that emerged, we know that the mob and the CIA hooked up together to plot to kill Fidel Castro. This is not conspiracy theory stuff. The CIA admitted this last year and released
Operation Mongoose, called the
Family Jewels, which detailed the CIA reaching out to Santo Traficante and others who were prominent players in Havana in the 50s who got chased out of there, knowing they would be angry and wanting revenge against Castro, forming a relationship with the mob to try to kill Castro. We know that thread took place. We also know how angry the mob became at Kennedy when Kennedy appointed his brother, Bobby Kennedy, Attorney General, and Bobby Kennedy went on a crusade against the mob, and the mob felt that they had helped get Jack Kennedy elected president and were angry as hell that the Kennedys were now engaged in a vendetta against them. This also is not conspiracy theory stuff. It's well known. There were a number of wiretaps of mobsters around the United States in the early 60s that detailed the anger, the resentment, the bitter resentment that was being expressed by various mob factions towards the Kennedy brothers. And so, again, it's one of these things that's likely we'll never be able to prove in court, but the circumstantial evidence about the mob anger towards the Kennedy brothers is pretty strong, and so I do believe that they were involved in the assassination.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is T.J. English. He's a journalist who's written a lot about the history of organized crime in the U.S. His books include Paddy Whacked and The Westies. They're both books that have to do with Irish-Americans involved in crime. He's also the author of the book Born to Kill, America's Most Notorious Vietnamese Gang. That was nominated for an Edgar Award. He's written for Esquire, for Playboy, for New York Magazine, among other publications. He's also a screenwriter and has written episodes of the TV crime dramas NYPD Blue and Homicide, and he's author of a new book that is titled Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. It's published by William Morrow. The book's just out now, and the questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There, you wrote a little essay that was included with the material that came with the book that I think has two great stories in it that says a lot about how people in the United States government, at least, and people in the Cuban government think about all of this and the relationship with the two countries. And there's sort of these two parallel stories. And the first one was about when you needed to get permission from the U.S. government. You were applying to get permission to go to Cuba. And you explained to them, well, I'm writing this book. I'm going to do research. This is what I'm going to do. And the first time around, they said, no, you can't go. And then you reapplied. And when you reapplied and when you told them what you were going to do, you said, well, I'm going to write this book about how the mob provided arms to Castro and the rebels, which was not true. But when the U.S. government apparently heard that, they said, okay, solid, you can go.
Right, right. Well, you know, one of the things about engaging in this kind of journalistic research is you have to learn how to, what code words to use, what the various bureaucracies need and want to hear before they're going to give you approval. Some of that you know ahead of time. Some of that you figure out as you go along. Getting to Cuba, and I wanted to do it legally. Americans do travel there often via third countries. You know, you can fly to Mexico and fly into Cuba or fly to Canada and then fly to Cuba. Some tourists do that. But I wanted this to be on the up and up. I wanted to get approval from both governments to be there and to be doing this research. And so that involved getting a special license from the U.S. Treasury Department. And, it was, as you say, I applied and was rejected for reasons that were never explained. But they do tell you you can reapply again a second time. So I did, and I just kind of tweaked it a little bit. I changed the politics of the application a little bit. And then on the Cuban side, of course, I arrive in Cuba in July of 2006. It's right at the time that Fidel has gone down with his mystery disease. And there's a lot of crazy rumors going on that Fidel is dying or that Castro is already dead and the government is hiding it. The Cuban government was kicking foreign journalists out of the country. They were not allowing journalists into the country. They were trying to control the flow of information from the island. And so here I arrive with my tape recorders and notepads looking a lot like a American journalist. And I was immediately pulled aside at the airport in Havana by military customs and taken to a special area and thoroughly interrogated. It was a friendly interrogation, but it was very thorough. They went through every single item in my luggage and asked me what it was. And I just told them the truth. I said I wasn't a journalist. I wasn't there researching what was going on with Fidel's health, that I was researching this very specific subject of the mob in Cuba in the 1950s. I knew they would be predisposed to allow me to research this subject because the Cuban government is proud of the fact that they chased the mafia out of Cuba in the 1950s. It's a story that they don't mind having told. But I still had to convince the bureaucracy that I was legit and all of that. I had packed in my bags right on top of my luggage. The first thing you saw when you opened my suitcase was a paperback copy of the collected writings of Jose Martí. Jose Martí is a revered figure in Cuban history, poet, activist, died in the War of Independence in Cuba in 1898. Greatly revered by all political factions in Cuba, but especially by the Castro and the revolution. When the military customs guy saw this book, you could see his eyes light up and feel the weight being lifted from his shoulders and the weight being lifted from my shoulders. And I'm pretty sure that that was the good omen that got me into the country.
Yeah. We talked earlier about the fact that going back to the 20s, going back to the time of Prohibition, that some people involved in American organized crime thought there was great potential for Cuba, for being a place where they could operate freely, they could make a lot of money, they could have set up casinos and hotels, and as you explained, they got involved in the banks, they were highly connected with the Cuban government, and I'm sure that more people than just Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano had this idea that that would be a great place to be. And there was, in fact, a very famous meeting of leaders from organized crime families that took place in Havana in 1946 to sort of work out the idea about how everything would be divided up. And, in fact, if people have seen The Godfather 2, they see something like this. Something like this happens with the involvement of the fictitious Corleone family. So how did they, you know, given the fact that I'm sure that sooner or later people in American organized crime got onto the fact that this was a huge pot of money.
Mm-hmm.
How did they go about trying to figure out how that could be divided up so that a number of people could take advantage and you didn't have people, too many people, like Mr. Anastasia, thinking about how they weren't getting enough, and you didn't have people whacking each other just because right. they thought, well, they should be getting more of the take.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. I mean, that's basically, you're asking how they put the organized in organized crime. And, you know, when Prohibition in the 1920s made mega stars out of a lot of mobsters in major cities around the United States, gangsters went from being, you know, hoodlums and hustlers to being very powerful people that had a lot of money to influence political systems. And in New York, we had a thing called the Machine, Tammany Hall, the Machine, and all of that was kind of the link between the underworld elements and the political elements and corrupt law enforcement elements. And it's the American underworld, a kind of underworld of connections that really is behind how things operate in the United States. This structure began to take shape, or at least it began to be infused with all this fabulous wealth in the 1920s. When Prohibition ended, the more powerful and astute leaders of the mob, people like Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello and Santo Traficante and others, put their heads together and over the course of decades created a kind of ruling commission that would meet on a semi-regular basis every 5 years, 8 years, 10 years to discuss their plans for the future and to make sure that everyone was satisfied with the way things were being divided up. And so the American underworld was kind of organized along a kind of a corporate structure. In fact, this generation of mobsters, Lansky and Luciano, very much saw themselves as the first generation of mobsters who were, to their way of thinking, on a par with CEOs of American corporations. They didn't see themselves as sort of an old world mafia connected to the old country, to the old traditions of the old country. No, they viewed themselves in a very American context as a corporation and as corporate leaders. And today, you know, the mob is pretty much gone, so it's hard for us to imagine what a powerful force this was back in the decades of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And they would meet and discuss, the various territorial disputes and whatnot. And Lansky was a particular master at running an operation where everyone got their piece of the pie, and it was done with a minimum of violence. And it was very kind of well-organized and well-structured, and that structure remained in place for quite a number of years. Now, it's so many curious things about this. J. Edgar Hoover denied that this structure existed for the longest time, really, until the only thing that sort of made Hoover change his tune was in 1963 when Joe Valachi testified and sort of laid everything out in the Valachi hearings, and Hoover really couldn't pretend that it didn't exist anymore. But, you know, right through the 40s and 50s, the FBI was in denial about the fact that there was a ruling commission and that the mob factions in different cities were connected in some way. And there's always been a lot of speculation about why Hoover was in denial about it. But that was a fact. And so the mob was able to operate in a somewhat structured way, thanks to visionary leaders like people like Meyer Lansky.
Yeah. Do you put any stock in the explanation, as some people advance, is that the mob had actually something on Hoover? You know, we also think that Hoover had something on everybody, but some people say, well, the mob had something on Hoover, so for that reason, for such a long time, he said, no, well, there's no such thing.
Well, the underworld legend, there is a story. I didn't use it in the book. It has been used in other books. I think it comes under the heading of underworld lore more than anything else. It may be true, but there's no real evidence of it. It's said that Meyer Lansky did have photos of J. Edgar Hoover, compromising photos of J. Edgar Hoover dressed up in women's clothes, or sexually compromising positions with his boyfriend, Clyde Tolson. We do know that J. Edgar Hoover was a transsexual. This has been documented in biographies about Hoover, and I do think there is evidence to support it. Hoover lived with his boyfriend, Clyde Tolson, for many years, and people saw him in functions, dressed up in women's clothes. Hoover had this secret life. That, I do believe, can be proven and has been documented. Whether or not Meyer Lansky had photos of Hoover that made him take this position that the mob wasn't what others were saying that it was, I don't know about that. But it is curious that Hoover, who would have known, had to have known, certainly, that the mob did exist at the level that it would later be proven that he did, that why he was in denial about it all these decades.
Let's talk with some other folks. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I heard mention a while ago, talk of the film Godfather 2, and I was just wondering what other films had interesting portrayals of Havana in the 50s, particularly during the 1950s. Were there any gangster movies that presented scenes from that era? Thanks.
Okay.
Well, you know, gangster movies, there certainly were gangster movies in the 50s. Many of them starred George Raft, who wound up becoming a prominent figure in Havana. George Raft was an actor who had played mobsters in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He was eventually hired by one of the casinos, the Capri Hotel and Casino in Havana, to serve as kind of a meter and greeter at the casino to play George Raft, basically. So he was sort of a symbolic connection of the Hollywood scene and the gangster scene in Havana. There's no movies of the 50s that deal in any way, in any kind of honest or interesting way, with what was really happening in the American underworld. Godfather Part II is really the only movie that does it any kind of justice, I think. There was a movie called Havana that was made, directed by Sidney Pollack and starring Robert Redford. I don't think it's much of a movie. You know, movies are inhibited by the fact that you can't shoot them in Cuba because of the economic embargo, the trade embargo that the United States government has with Cuba. So any movies about this period wind up being filmed on sets or being filmed in some other country, so you don't really get the full atmosphere and flavor of it. So, no, it's a subject that's yet to be fully explored as a movie, and you know, it was shocking to me, surprising, that this book hadn't been written before, because this subject has been sitting there for about 50 years now. And this is a book that could have, should have been written decades ago. But I think part of that is the embargo, which makes it difficult to go there and do the research. And it would make it difficult to go there and shoot a movie. So that might have something to do with why it hasn't happened.
Yeah, about 6-7 minutes left. Just let me mention the book just real quick. We're talking this morning with journalist T.J. English. He's written a lot about organized crime in the United States. His most recent book is Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. It's published by William Morrow. The book's just out now. So that sounds interesting to you. It's got a lot of good stories in there. You might take a look at it. Questions welcome here, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Atlanta, Illinois is the next caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen, and I think the author's exactly right. It's about time this book was written. Back years ago in the 50s, I think it was on the U of I reading list, there was a book called I'm Down So Far, It Looks Up to Me, and it discussed as part of that book, looking at the spectrum of people that went to Cuba at that time, that that was a great spring break destination for students. And being of that age at that time, till I read that book, I wasn't aware of that. And I wonder if the book was just exaggerating, or was that true?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it quite that way, because Havana was an adult destination. It wasn't, you know, when you say spring break, it makes people think of Fort Lauderdale and Girls Gone Wild and teenagers running wild. Havana was definitely a destination spot for tourists and revelers from the United States, mostly adults, though. It was very much an adult scene down there. You needed money to go down there and make the most of it, to circulate in the nightclubs and the casinos. But it can't be as underestimated what a draw it actually was. You know, the nightlife scene which I've just sort of briefly touched on, the music and the dance scene and the elaborate floor shows at the nightclubs and the use of Afro-Cuban culture in the entertainment scene down there was very exotic and exciting. And season after season, it drew huge throngs of tourists from the United States and from Europe, and also the high roller gamblers who were down there to gamble, and then, all, as I mentioned before, all the politicians and celebrities that were there. So as a scene, as a place to be, as an entertainment scene, it really was quite a draw, and people did head down there on a seasonal basis. I think it was mostly guys, though, young men who left their wives at home, who headed down there for sexual tourism that was so famous down there. I mean, the sexual marketplace was pretty elaborate. There were bordellos and prostitution, of course, but there were also live sex shows that took place there. There's a scene in Godfather 2 where Michael Corleone takes his brother and some visiting dignitaries to a seedy little sex show in Havana. That was a real place. It was called the Shanghai Theater. It was notorious. So it was pretty naughty, but it was an adult form of entertainment for the most part.
So if college kids went down there, it was probably rich males that might have escaped down there on spring break.
Yeah, that sounds like more like what it would be. But it was more mostly, you know, there was a lot of military people that would go pass through there and take part in the nightlife there. It was mostly well-off Americans and European adult males down there.
One thing that struck me was, at least to get there, it was not terribly expensive. Given even the difference in money, I would think it would be, it still would have been pretty cheap. And I think you mentioned in the book that Pan Am Airways offered a round-trip fare from Miami to Havana for $39?
Yeah. No, they made it real affordable, real easy to get there. And everyone was in on that. You know, it's funny. The mobsters had the casinos, but a lot of the hotels, you know, a hotel might be owned by the Hilton hotel chain, for instance, and within that hotel would be a casino owned and run by the Lansky brothers or other notorious mob figures. And Pan Am Airways, of course, was benefiting from this tourism boom. So the Cuban people, the people sympathetic to the revolution, could be forgiven for looking at this situation and thinking that the mob and the American corporations and the corrupt politicians in Cuba were all kind of in it together, that it was one entity.
Let's talk with someone in Mattoon, line one. Hello.
Yeah, so I'd like to go back to the gentleman's comments about J. Edgar Hoover. I totally disagree with him. His facts are wrong. Is that Clyde Tolson did not live with J. Edgar Hoover. They lived totally separate. There is no one that is credible that has ever seen Mr. Hoover being a cross-dresser. There is one lady who had mental problems and mental issues who has made that allegation. People like the gentleman you're speaking with continue to repeat that lie, and since it's been repeated often enough, people like him appear to believe it. I would like to find his facts where he can document that this is a proven fact. I think it's well known that Mr. Hoover was surveilled by agents, and there was many agents that he fired, had disagreements with. And if what he was saying is true, all these years, some of that information would have come out. Secondly, with all the issues and problems, if there was photographs, I think after all of these years, those would have surfaced.
Well, Mr. English, what do you say?
Well, that's a legitimate point. I don't think we have time to go into all the details on this subject, but I would refer readers to a biography of Hoover by Anthony Summers, and there have been other biographies of Hoover that deal in much more detail than we can do here about these facts. These are not stray facts that are thrown around. They've been examined pretty closely in these biographies of Hoover, and I would urge anyone who has feelings about this subject one way or the other to look at the public record as it exists today and make that decision for themselves. I think the evidence is pretty compelling.
All right. Again, we go to another caller here, and this would be Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment. My father lived in
Miami in the early 50s, and he used to take the car ferries that they had over to Havana to gamble and party, whatever, and he used to tell me stories about it. But one of the things that you don't mention is the connection between Newport, Kentucky and Las Vegas and Havana, Cuba. Could you expand on that?
I do mention that a little bit in the book. One of Lansky's partners had run a casino in Newport and wound up being one of the casino managers in Havana. You know, there was a gambling circuit. This is another thing that we forget. In the years before Las Vegas and Atlantic City, gambling existed in a kind of regional way all around the United States. There were a number of pockets, jurisdictions around the United States where they had casinos and illegal casinos that were owned and run by mob figures. And so there was a whole casino gambling network around the United States, and Newport was one of those places. And a lot of the people who had managed and run casinos in Newport wound up working in Havana in the 50s.
I'm sorry to say at the point we're going to have to finish. We have about a minute or so left. Just one thing I'd like to ask you to talk about a little bit at the end here is something that you mentioned that here at the end of your introduction, essentially that you cannot understand the present-day relation between the governments of Cuba and the U.S. without first knowing about this time period that you write about in the book.
Yes. Well, a lot of that has to do with the role that this era played in fueling the revolution. And I do think that this mobster exploitation of Cuba that took place in the 50s was one of the factors that led to the feelings of resentment that eventually gave birth to the revolution. And then once Cuba fell and the revolutionary government took over, you have a narrative thread that runs through American history of Cuban exiles who left Cuba or were forced out of Cuba by Castro trying to get revenge and forming relationships with the mobsters and in some cases with the CIA and in some cases just on their own attempting to overthrow the Castro government, to assassinate Fidel, to reclaim all that had been lost in the 1950s. And so this era of the 1950s, many of the relationships and the resentments that began during this period infected U.S.-Cuban relations over the next 40 or 50 years and, in fact, became a kind of determining fact in the policies of the U.S. government and the Cuban government towards each other. So it's very much a factor in where we're at now in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba.
There, we're going to have to leave it for this morning. Again, more in the book if you'd like to read it, the title Havana Nocturne, How the Mob Owned Cuba and Then Lost It to the Revolution. The book is published by William Morrill by our guest T.J. English. You might also look at some of his other work, Paddy Whacked, The Westies, and Born to Kill, America's Most Notorious Vietnamese Gang. Mr. English, thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast this on August 26th. All of our programs, many of our past programs, are available on the website, Will, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. You can listen to past Focus interviews, AFTMEG programs, a lot of our local productions there. It's ready for you anytime that you like. Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Programs also made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 to 1, Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up this afternoon at 1, we'll have another chance to hear the Uni High School student documentary Competing Against Discrimination, Achieving Equality and Athletics at the University of Illinois. Students interviewed 16 individuals who overcame obstacles because of race, gender, or disability. That's Competing Against Discrimination this afternoon at 1 o'clock. It's 1 minute before noon. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3, Urbana. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat is trading at 558. That's down one half. March, 577, up one. In Chicago, December wheat, 536, up one half. March, 559, up five. December corn, 349, down five. March, 365 and a quarter, down five and three quarters. May, 374 and a quarter, down eight. July, 388, down five and three quarters. January soybeans, 884, down two. March, 901, up seven. May, 888 and a half, down 15 and a quarter. July, 907, down six. December soybean meal, 261 even, down 220. December oil, 32 even, down 50. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 87.35, down 7.5. February, 80.